spoke to him about what to do if someone is choking. The Mesa Fire Department honored Thomas with a certificate of appreciation for his heroic actions.
Oklahoma State Superintendent Ryan Walters plans to require schools to collect data on students' immigration status, framing it as a way to address illegal immigration's impact on education. The ACLU and opponents argue the move fosters fear and violates constitutional protections, promising legal challenges. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Earl Ingram.
Mr. Ben Wickler is running for the national DNC chair. The fundamental problem was the Democratic brand. Do you think that is the case more than the Harris campaign?
Core answer is yes. The Democratic brand, it's not what we necessarily do or say. It's what people have heard and internalized. And that to me is an argument for thinking about how and where we communicate, making sure we are present in places where people are thinking about stuff other than politics.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local civic media radio station. And on the app. The Todd Alba Show.
UW System spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants. Three times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
The Todd Alba Show.
UW System spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants. Three times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Have you ever heard of a marten? Not Martin the person, but Martin the animal. It's Wisconsin's only state endangered mammal. And now there are new efforts to protect its population. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
The Federal Department of the Interior has awarded the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission more than $800,000 for recovery efforts for American martens. Jonathan Pauly is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. He says silvicultural practices and logging within local national forests altered martens' preferred habitats.
This work is really trying to understand how do we manage habitat in a meaningful way on these working landscapes to increase marten habitat and connectivity of these different subpopulations to ensure martens are here for the foreseeable future.
Pauly says the grant money will bring together a diverse group of folks from the federal, state, tribal, and academic levels over 4 years. They'll create a forest management proposal with recommended habitat improvements for marten recovery in Wisconsin. Pauly says martens play important cultural, economic, and ecological roles, including the ability, as predators, to keep rodent populations at bay and are culturally significant to the Ojibwe or Chippewa people.
They actually live and hunt underneath that snowpack. that they can slink in and out from underneath the snow, where they can hunt all the mice that are living underneath the snow, and then pop up out of the snowbank. And they have big feet, like snowshoe hares almost, where they can surf on top of the snow.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly cloudy, highs near 18. For tonight, mostly cloudy, 13. Partly sunny for Sunday with a high near 30. 33 and a slight chance of snow on your Monday. For Monday night, clouds and 24. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high around 32.
Currently, one above.
Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, a simple way to reduce the burden on property taxpayers. Have the legislature go back to paying its fair share for special education.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings starting at 6. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this hour and also next hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me for this, our weekly weekend review, our analysis, our deliberation, our consideration of major stories in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America and beyond. As always, we are taking your phone calls and your inquiries, your questions here at the Civic Media stations. That telephone number is 855-752-4842. And Max, my wonderful producer, also tells me that you can be in communication with us as well by dropping a question, an inquiry into the Civic Media line, letting us know what you're thinking about, asking questions about our always ambitious but achievable agenda. And yes, we've got just that going on this weekend as well. Let's talk first about what is on that syllabus for this weekend show. We're going to begin exactly where we ended off in our last broadcast of last weekend. And that is once again talking about guns in America, the problems that we are facing, not only in the nation generally, but certainly right here in Wisconsin as well. As we were reminded graphically and horrifically on Monday of this past week, we're going to talk a little bit about what happened on Monday at the Abundant Life Christian School, the latest mass shooting here in the state of Wisconsin. We'll give you some statistics on the nature of the problem which visits us here in Wisconsin and throughout the nation. We're going to talk beyond that about the problems we are confronting routinely in America. I've continued to confront guns in America, not only a law enforcement issue, which is the reason why we bring it up here on Amicus, a law review, but also a healthcare issue. It is a healthcare crisis in America when these kinds of things continue to happen. Guns in America, once again, visiting not only our agenda, but visiting our lives and our livelihoods in our nation and our state. Reminded as well where we stopped off last broadcast talking about the Glock, probably the 3D printed Glock that was used by Luigi Mangione to kill Brian Thompson, who, of course, is the CEO of United Healthcare on December 4th of this month. We're going to chat generally about guns in America as a part of our initial discussion and review of challenges facing us here in our nation. Also going to talk about the mechanisms by which Luigi Mangione has been and is going to be prosecuted by both state and federal prosecutors. We'll tell you something about the nature of those parallel charges going on with respect to Mangione and that investigation, the prosecution in both state and federal venues there in New York. Then necessarily staying somewhat in New York, we're going to talk about two major developments having to do with those continuing criminal cases against our president-elect, who takes office in a short 30 days from now. We will spend some time chatting about a major thing that Juan Merchan, the New York justice, the judge presiding over that hush money false statements case, what he did just this past week that signals that at least there is some continued life in that prosecution, if not in the long-term future. We'll tell you about what he did in connection with the United States Supreme Court's decision of just under 6 months or so ago, finding that, in fact, presidents have immunity for crimes committed in office. We'll tell you how it is, according to Juan Merchan, that that particular decision does not prevent him from going ahead with the further administration of that case and the prosecution of it by District Attorney Alvin Bragg in that venue. Much related to it, but in a variety of different areas in Georgia, in particular, Fani Willis, the subject of a major appeals court decision of just this past week as well, finding that indeed she does have to be removed from the case, as does her office. A decision, a major surprising decision from the appeals court there in Georgia, overturning the decision of Scott McAfee, the trial judge who found previously that her relationship with a co-worker on the prosecution team, not a conflict of interest, but nonetheless an appearance of impropriety, sufficient to compel that co-worker be removed from the case. We'll talk about what the appeals court did, what happens next in both that case in Georgia and also the state of New York, that state case pending in front of Juan Merchan. What's next? What's coming up next in both of those cases? Next on our agenda, again, our ambitious but achievable agenda this weekend, we're going to talk about the merits and, yes, the demerits, the considerable demerits of that lawsuit brought, a civil lawsuit brought by our president-elect against a number of people, including the Des Moines Register, an attempt to thwart, if you will, the First Amendment rights and prerogatives of the media in our nation to print legitimate news, including here the results of a poll that turned out to be wrong, but nonetheless a poll that existed at the time. We'll talk about the merits and demerits of that particular prosecution and the real reason why it has been brought, again, to limit and to try to scare off the legitimate work of media in our nation. And then we're going to go overseas and do the third installment of something we've talked about at great length on past broadcasts, and that is the remarkable, stunning, shocking prosecution of Dominique Pellicot and 49, almost 50 other men for the vicious and horrific sexual assault upon Giselle Pellicot and arguably other people over a period of a decade. That case, after months of prosecution, it was basically their O.J. Simpson case there in France, riveting attention by virtually every member of the French population. That case now being brought to conclusion with the findings of guilty and the imposition of sentences on all of them. We'll tell you exactly what the court panel did in France. And finally, coming back to the United States, another high court review, and that is what our Supreme Court has done just this past week. Last broadcast, we talked about the decisions that the Supreme Court has made in not reviewing, not granting writs of certiorari to various cases pending out there. We're going to chat this week about three cases that it's decided to review, to analyze, to hear oral argument on, and ultimately to decide, presumably, sometime in 2025, probably later into the spring and summer. One case involving TikTok and the legislation that was signed by the president, passed by the Congress with respect to its future here in America. A second major abortion case having to do with Planned Parenthood, that now on the docket of the United States Supreme Court. And finally, some issues related to religion. Once again, a First Amendment issue. This one not about media, but about religion in America. And the question about whether or not charities have to pay unemployment taxes, the connection between government and charities, never before addressed by the Supreme Court, although lots of precedent plainly in the other area of the intersection of government and private entities, public entities as well. We'll chat about those new cases now on the docket of the United States Supreme Court as of just this past week. All of that, again, on Amicus, a law review in this hour and also next hour. Once again, inviting you to be a part of our conversation. That number, once again, is 855-752-4842. 855-752-4842. Always interested, always soliciting your questions and your inquiries about things that are on our agenda. We are sobered and we are always thoughtful about guns in America, especially when those sobering events bring us again to confront the decisions being made today by our legislatures, many of them, including right here in the state of Wisconsin, not to act, to do those things that we know they can do, that we can do, that will not completely eliminate, but will reduce the incidence of gun violence in America. We know a lot. We know a lot about gun violence in America. We know that in 2024, this calendar year alone, we've got 10 days left. There are more than 488 mass shootings in this year alone. We've got 10 days left. Probably going to reach another, not landmark, but significant numeric event here. Probably more mass shootings in the last days of this year. Again, going to populate the terrible news in our nation about mass shootings. Mass shootings generally defined as shootings involving four or more people. Some of them may be killed. Some of them may be injured. Four or more individuals shot in the course of one particular event. In each of the last 4 years in America, there have been more than 600 mass shootings. That's almost two a day in our nation. About 50 people are killed every day, not just from mass shootings, but in other areas and other ways, are killed every day from firearms in America. In 2021 alone, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, almost 49,000 people lost their lives. They died as a result of gun-related injuries in America. More than half of those suicide-related. We know as well, based upon an awful lot of calculations out there, that the numbers of guns exceeds the population of the United States of America. Almost 400 million guns in circulation right now. Of course, that's not to say that every American has a gun, but just that we've got lots of guns out there. Lots of guns out there to cause the kinds of tragedies, the human tragedies that we have seen again in recent weeks, months, years. And again, just this past week, and that includes, of course, here in Wisconsin, in Madison. Medical examiner this past week finally naming the two victims who died in the shooting of this past Monday at the Abundant Life Christian School, attracting, of course, appropriately, the national attention, the world attention. Once again, another mass shooting in America. The identified victims are Ruby Vergara, who's 14. She's a student. She was a resident of Madison. And Erin West, who she was 42 years old. She lived in nearby DeForest, Wisconsin, listed in a staff directory as a substitute coordinator at the Abundant Life Christian School. We know from all of the reporting that a second-grade teacher called 911 at about 10:57 a.m. on Monday to report a shooting inside the school. That reported now accurately by Chief Sean Barnes of the Madison Police Department. Chief Barnes, again, providing some information about what happened that day, including the injuries suffered by others who were taken to the hospital, the names that identification of those not yet publicly identified, at least two in critical condition as a result of this mass shooting at the Abundant Life Christian School here in the state of Wisconsin, just in our area, just outside of the downtown Madison area there. The shooting took place again in the midst of our greater concerns about guns in America. We'll chat more about that as Amicus Law Review continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Big news in Wisconsin this month, as much of the controversial anti-union Act 10 law was struck down in a ruling by Dane County Circuit Court Judge Jacob Frost. Two takeaways on this. One, the ruling gets at the heart of what has always made this law so brazenly political, by defining public safety employees differently from general public employees. That decision was pretty clearly made not based on across-the-board policy, but on which unions backed Scott Walker for governor in 2010. It would be fitting if that is what ultimately spells the end for this controversial law. Secondly, this case is headed to an appeal, which almost certainly will end up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court. While this case still might be decided by the court's current 4-3 liberal majority, it's a good reminder of just how important the upcoming race for state Supreme Court will be.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I'm your host this hour and next hour as well for our discussion of all things related to government, law, and the aspiration for justice. Beginning our broadcast again this weekend, as we ended our broadcast last weekend talking about guns in America, we know what can solve, if not completely, but go a far way in solving the problem of guns in America, the continued onslaught, not only of mass shootings, but these horrific numbers of deaths as a result of gun-related injuries. We know it can solve those kinds of things because we've had history in some of this. We had a 10-year moratorium on assault weapons in America back in the 1990s, and we know that as a result of that, the number of these kinds of mass shootings declined, especially those, of course, using assault weapons of the kind that were prohibited. That law, that federal legislation, sunsetted, has never been put back in place, and so the numbers of assault weapons there has continued to grow, as have the number of injuries caused by them in America. We know that things, simple things, appropriate things, like universal background checks, closing the so-called gun show loophole here in Wisconsin, other places, would have a dramatic impact upon access to guns by people who are, by their very nature, violent, who should not have weapons. That is a way of solving this problem. Talked before about the fact that many of these cases, more than half of them, involve suicides. We know that in those states that have imposed and established what are called emergency violent protective orders or emergency response protective orders, these are the processes by which individuals, family members, typically identify someone in their family, in their region of knowledge, who seems to be in a threatening position because of a psychological or mental issue, and yet has a gun. And under those circumstances, these laws permit those caring family members, those caring community members, to see a judge and say, "Judge, this particular person who I care for, who I love, I'm concerned about, has a gun and seems to be suffering in some way. Impose upon us all. Direct the local law enforcement to go out and remove that gun temporarily, not permanently, temporarily from that person to prevent a suicide, to prevent that person from engaging in any other violent conduct which would affect the life and the livelihood of someone else." Those are emergency response protective orders, sometimes also called red flag orders or legislation in the area. We know that those work. We know that those work because they happen routinely in America and can solve these problems as well. Inside homes, we know that legislation and laws that require safekeeping of weapons also keep weapons outside of the hands of young people and other people who might otherwise have access to them in ways that could compromise safety and security. There are a host of things that can be done legislatively and can also be done by others in our community. And that includes not just in the wake of what happened in Madison, but in other situations, the American public standing up and saying no more. We know by virtue of statistics on all of this and polls taken, the American public overwhelmingly supports these kinds of things that will prevent the kinds of gun violence that we saw again in Madison, other places around the nation. We know that the nation, the population of America, supports them. And indeed, just this past week, in the wake of the horrific shooting there at the Abundant Life Christian School in Madison, more than 100 people, led by teens, protested the failure of our state legislature to act in some of these ways. using plainly, invoking the horror of what happened at the Abundant Life Christian School. More than 100 people, mostly led by teenagers, took to the state capitol, the building itself in Madison, to demand action from lawmakers. Just on Friday of this past week, a crowd walking through the halls, signs chanting, "No more silence, end gun violence." It was a chant that was echoed by Representative Francesca Hong. She's from Madison. She said she was thanking the Madison High School students who braved the cold to come protest gun violence at the Capitol. She said, "We as policymakers need to do better for you on behalf of you. The Abundant Life Christian School community is equally in our hearts and our minds today." And she also, as do all of us who care about these things, recognize that hearts and minds and caring thoughts are important, but they do not get the job done. And so we need to call upon legislators once again, not just in memory of the two victims, the others who were injured just this past week in Madison, but the many, many other people, the 49,000 people who have died of gun-related injuries every year in America, the 600 or so mass shootings in the last 4 years. We're on track now, approaching 500 mass shootings in 2024 alone as we begin to close out this calendar year. On behalf of all of those people, for the safety and security of all of Americans, we need to do better. We need to invoke those things that we do know work and make them happen. Meanwhile, of course, law enforcement, including law enforcement right there in Madison, continues to focus upon the gun, the 9mm weapon. That's a part of the investigation, of course, that comes in the wake of that shooting at Abundant Life. Plainly, lots of questions about where the young shooter who took her life, one of the three victims there at that time, where did she get that gun? And certainly that is the focus of a lot of law enforcement activity right now. We don't know. We don't know about this. We don't know exactly where it came from, how she got access to it. But we do know that there is some precedent out there for holding adults responsible for failing to do the things that they need to do. And not just turning a blind eye, but affirmatively not doing those preventive things that must and should be done to keep young people from going into schools and other places of common assembly and using weapons to catastrophic result. We know about Jennifer and James Crumbly, given at least 10 years in prison coming out of that Pontiac, Michigan, Oxford High School shooting in late November of 2021. Just 3 years ago, four students horrifically killed, another mass shooting in that state. Parents convicted of involuntary manslaughter and sentenced again to at least 10 years in prison, beginning to hold parents responsible when they fail to do, in that case, the most clear and obvious things to prevent those kinds of mass shootings from happening. We don't know. We don't know yet what happened in Madison, how that young shooter got that 9mm weapon. But that's the subject of continuing investigation, continuing pursuit by law enforcement there in Madison, appropriate to do it even as we work with legislators to get the results we need to get in America. All of that, our continuing discussion coming out once again of our own state here in Wisconsin. We are also mindful, of course, of the Brian Thompson assassination on December 4th in the streets of Manhattan. That, of course, perpetrated by Luigi Mangione, who just this past week was brought from Pennsylvania where he was apprehended. He was moved now to New York. And he is facing, interestingly, both federal and state charges. We're going to get to that in just a moment or so. Plainly, he is in custody for the shooting, not a mass shooting there, but using a gun once again. And interestingly, more and more indication that the gun that he used, as we began to talk in our broadcast last weekend, was a 3D printed gun using a popular design that's found online. At first glance, that gun, if you see in some of the police photographs, the one that the authorities believe that he used to kill the United Healthcare CEO, Brian Thompson, appears to be a Glock, a 9mm semi-automatic pistol used by military forces and police officers, civilians and criminals, frankly, around the world, including here in the United States. But in closer inspection, actually appears to be partially at least produced by a 3D printer. We're going to talk about the access of guns and the possibility of using guns violently, putting them together from 3D printing, apparently, according to what appears to be the investigative results coming out of that New York issue, as we continue here on Amicus, a law review.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. A car plowing into a holiday crowd at a Christmas market in Germany last night. At least five people killed, more than 200 injured. A suspect is in custody. ABC's Tom-Sophie Borridge is at the scene.
Sadly, the death toll could still rise further. There's a real sense of disbelief in this German city that an attack at a Christmas market just 5 days before Christmas could take place. And I think it's really important to underline this attack last night is not being called a terrorist attack, and there is no Islamist link at all to the horror that unfolded at that Christmas market late last night.
After days of heated negotiations on Capitol Hill and 11th-hour interference from President-elect Trump and his ally Elon Musk, the House passed a funding bill to prevent a government shutdown last night, with the Senate following suit early this morning. No winner last night, so Mega Millions rolls over again. The estimated jackpot now $944 million for Tuesday's drawing. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Bucks basketball tonight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It's the Bucks and the Washington Wizards tonight at Fiserv Farm in Milwaukee. The Bucks back from Cleveland, where they lost last night to the first place Cavaliers, 124-101. Cleveland has added bigger players to their roster. They've now beat the Bucks three times in a row this season. Giannis Antetokounmpo after the loss.
Yeah, it's definitely harder. You know, it's harder for you to get offensive rebounds, take possessions. They show a lot of crowd. It's hard for you to drive and kick. So yeah, they definitely make it harder for a lot of teams. Is this the last game of the season against them?
One more.
So yeah, it's good. It's a good challenge. You know, I'm excited to see them again.
NFL, the Packers face the Saints on Monday Night Football. Jaire Alexander trying to come back after missing the last month with a knee injury. Second year man Carrington Valentine on how the Packers defense has improved.
Yeah, we're trending the right way. As long as we keep keep practicing hard, you know, keep doing what we do, sky's the limit.
That's Packers defensive back Carrington Valentine with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly cloudy, highs near 18. For tonight, mostly cloudy, 13. Partly sunny for Sunday with a high near 30. 33 and a slight chance of snow on your Monday. For Monday night, clouds in 24. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high around 32.
Right now, 3 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. New York City Mayor Eric Adams was denied access to over $4 million in matching public funding for his 2025 campaign due to questions over an ongoing federal investigation and accusations of financial mismanagement. The U.S. Department of Justice filed charges against the mayor in September, charging him with taking campaign donations from foreign nationals and businessmen, allegedly using straw donors to make them appear as legitimate donations. He is also accused of doing favors in exchange for luxury travel and attempting to conceal these transactions, according to the DOJ. The New York City Campaign Finance Board ruled December 16th that Mayor Adams' request for $4.5 million in matching funds would be denied. The chair of the board said in a statement, "After thoroughly reviewing all available information, including the details of the indictment of Mayor Adams, the board has determined there is reason to believe the Adams campaign has engaged in conduct detrimental to the matching funds program in violation of law, including the Campaign Finance Act and board rules." New York City's campaign finance system provides an 8-to-1 match for small donations of $250 or less for mayor and $175 for city council. Such small donor financing systems promote transparency, discourage big money, and encourage less affluent candidates to run. We have links to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey K, will join us. Plus, does MAGA have their pitchforks and torches out for their own speaker, Mike Johnson? Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus Law Review. This is our weekly weekend review of things related to justice in America and beyond. Necessarily talking as we have in the past about guns in America, including not only that horrific shooting in Madison of just this past week, but earlier this month, December 4th, the shooting of the CEO executive Brian Thompson on the streets of Manhattan, talking about the gun that was almost certainly used to perpetrate that horrific crime. Initially appears to be a Glock 19, a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, but in fact probably at least partially produced from, yes, that's right, a 3D printer. The giveaways, according to early indications, are subtle but clear. The Glock logo is absent from the pistol's grip. This is the weapon that is appearing again in photographs provided by law enforcement. The angle of the grip is somewhat peculiar. The indentations on the grip, known as stippling, pattern in such a way the gun's fingerprint can be directly linked to a unique free-to-download 3D printed design known as the FMDA 19.2 Chairman One Remix. That's the name of the 3D gun, the 3D items that are assembled to produce this particular gun in all likelihood. Now, homemade firearms, as we know from past reporting and indeed from discussions before the United States Supreme Court, they've existed actually for centuries, fully 3D printed firearms around here in the United States and around the world since about 2013. As the Supreme Court engaged most recently in its discussion of ghost guns, talked a lot about hobbyists and the fact that hobbyists are ones who often produce these homemade 3D printed firearms. The rules and regulations vary by state. More than 25,000 privately made firearms were recovered in domestic seizures in 2022 alone, according to the United States Department of Justice. In some countries, not ours, with some more strict gun laws, these 3D printed weapons, which can be difficult to detect and trace by their very nature, are being used increasingly in crimes, leaving law enforcement agencies struggling to stop their proliferation and indeed causing problems for us here in America as well. We know that the pistol recovered from Mangione was not made up entirely of 3D printed parts. It had some metal components in it as well. Those apparently include the slide, that's the top portion of the gun, and also the barrel, which appeared, according to photographs, to be threaded, which allows a suppressor or a silencer to be attached. The pistol's magazine, according to viewing of it, which can often carry more than 10 cartridges and retails for around $25, appeared to have been store-bought. So it was a combination, kind of a hybrid, of a 3D and other items not made in 3D processing. The issue of guns, once again, looming large in America. And we know as well as I've indicated this weekend, but also in previous discussions, that guns continue to be the subject of a lot of focus by the United States Supreme Court. Most recently, in October, as we have reported and discussed right here on this broadcast, the Supreme Court taking up this case called Vanderstock, Garland versus Vanderstock, a challenge to the ATF rule that attempts to keep us a little bit safer, a little bit more secure if, in fact, guns are involved in violent activities. The rule established under the Biden administration by the present ATF requires that for ghost guns, that is these kits that you can order online, the your component parts, that they have serial numbers on the component pieces. Why is that? So that when you put them together and you create a firearm that in fact can work according to the way a firearm is defined in federal law, when you assemble that, if that gun is used in a crime of any kind, it can be traced. Therefore, we can find out where it came from, easier to trace it as a part of the all-important law enforcement work going on certainly right now in Madison, going on in New York and in other places around our nation where guns are involved in crimes. The United States Supreme Court taking up this case called Vanderstock in October, as we have discussed at length, and for the most part, seeming to indicate that they probably would support would support the decision by the ATF, by this administration, to impose this, what's frankly a very modest regulation. We're not talking about shutting down ghost guns entirely, although it could have that effect long term economically, but requiring manufacturers to place serial numbers and other identifying information on those component pieces, again, for purposes of law enforcement tracing. Not a huge imposition, but nonetheless, Vanderstock and others challenging that as a violation of Second Amendment rights under those cases called Heller and Bruin. We've talked a lot about those as well. The United States Supreme Court appeared not to buy into the notion that somehow those Supreme Court prior cases require that the ATF stand down and rescind or be pushed back on the enforcement of that rule. And that's the way things stood in October of this year. And then something significant happened in November. And that is that we elected a president who almost certainly is going to change that ATF rule that keeps us somewhat more safe and more secure by imposing this regulation upon ghost guns in America, indicating likely that he would, in a Trump administration, rescind that rule. And what would the effect of that be? Well, again, enabling the use of these guns in crimes and in other settings that prohibit the capacity of law enforcement to trace them accurately and promptly. Of course, before the Supreme Court, what that would mean is that the case almost certainly would be withdrawn. And the likelihood that we would get in May or June of this coming year a definitive decision by the Supreme Court that indeed federal agencies can do things, can rule in ways that keep us safer and secure, a larger theme that we talk a lot about here on our weekend broadcast, the capacity of agencies to engage in the work that they should be doing to keep us safe and secure, probably not going to be decided by the Supreme Court because of the likely withdrawal of this rule, therefore the mooting, M-O-O-T, becoming moot, that case before the Supreme Court, and therefore probably by the next Solicitor General under the Trump administration, probably removing that case from the Supreme Court docket because there's no more challenge to a rule that would no longer exist. And that is not a good thing, but it also underscores the significance, of course, of changes in the presidency. The significance of your vote for the presidency of the United States of America has an impact upon violence in America, gun-related violence, and the ways in which we can do things to keep us all more safe and secure, not just in New York, not just in Wisconsin, not just in Madison and Milwaukee and in La Crosse and Green Bay and Stevens Point and Eau Claire and all places around our state, but in every community in our nation. Guns continue to be a very significant issue for us all to discuss and to be a part of the advocacy to address the issue legislatively, but also in our public domains. Delighted to have joining me for some of our discussion this morning a good friend, colleague here on Civic Media, an icon in Milwaukee throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond, who is an articulate voice for all of this, and he's Earl Ingram. Earl, glad to have you with me this weekend. How delighted it is to be a part of conversation with you today and always.
It's an honor and a privilege, my friend. I would just say that all those accolades that you talked about before my name, I don't know who that is. I know
who it is.
I live in a city that has an urban centers across this nation where blood runs in the streets.
Yes.
Daily. Children, 5, 6, 8 years old, killed with regularity by guns. 12, 13-year-old children who have accessibility to guns that have been turned into automatic weapons because somehow they can purchase things that are created for God. God only knows
Yes. Why
somebody creates something that can turn a handgun into an automatic weapon. But as bad as that is, it's easy for these young people to get their hands on it. For God's sake, we live in a nation where less than 40%, I mean, 40% or more of the American people own guns. 60% of us don't. Mm-hmm. Why are we held hostage, Jim, by 40% of the people who own guns? The majority of us don't want that.
Right.
So we just saw this horrific event in Madison. There'll be others. It'll continue. We make up, Americans make up 4% of the global population, yet most of the killings, we kill more people by handgun, by guns, than almost the rest of the world combined. So we know this. We know this makes no sense, but yet the people can't control it. They have, the lobbyists have control over our elected officials. The majority of the, many of the American people don't even understand the process. And so here's where we are. We'll continue to be in this condition. Jim, it's heartbreaking that the American people don't understand this. The majority of us apparently don't understand it, and yet we're held hostage. It's a great topic. You know, I just, it's hard for me to believe that we're still here.
We are still talking about it, right? Right. And these earlier.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely right. And again, a couple of thoughtful follow-ups on your terrific commentary, which is we've got a Supreme Court that, again, last term said, you know what, the ATF cannot regulate exactly what you were just talking about, these bump stocks that can turn semi-automatic weapons, pistols, into machine guns, basically, weapons of war. Supreme Court said, no, you can't regulate those. There's a problem there as well. People, as you just said, Earl, we need to be demanding better of our appointed representatives, in that case on the Supreme Court. Our elected representatives can pass legislation to address those kinds of things. And then, as you've been advocating throughout your career, and again, I look to these 100 mostly teenagers who took to the Capitol just on Friday of this past week and said no more. The next generations, we are passing along this legacy of a nation run rampant when it comes to guns. We know it can solve this problem. Repeating your rhetorical question, why aren't we doing it? Why are we not doing it? We need to do better. We need to do better in 2025. Maybe that's one of our resolutions to go forward, my friend, and work more on addressing this issue, getting it done, because it hasn't been done up to now. Earl, I thank you so much for your calling in, your commentary. As always, good to be with you. We will chat more about that with you and with your listeners as well on Civic Media about all of this as the issue continues to plague our nation, plaguing our nation on a weekly basis, a daily basis, and with clear signs about what we can do to remedy the problem, and yet do not have the political will, apparently, to do just that. Coming out of that Luigi Mangione horrific assassination in New York, also some interesting legal issues having to do with the way in which he has been charged. As I indicated further, Mangione now back in New York facing both federal and state charges. Federal and state prosecutors charging him just this past week with the killing again of that chief executive in Manhattan. It's sort of a two-pronged legal offensive that's going to maybe not complicate, but sort of add two dimensions to this. The Manhattan DA's office charging Mangione with one count of first-degree murder. That's a terrorism-related offense. Also charging with two second-degree counts and a weapons crime as well. Interesting, while those state charges are brought against Mangione, the U.S. Attorney's Office, this is the U.S. Department of Justice, these are the federal authorities, Southern District of New York, charging with one count of murder, two counts of stalking, and a firearms offense. Again, to some extent, both of those kinds of charges addressing what Earl and I and all of you have been talking about. The maximum punishment for state charges is life without parole. If convicted on the federal charges, Mangione could face the death penalty, which is significant, of course. The state case almost certainly go to trial before the federal one. State prosecutors said they would coordinate, as they always do with federal agencies. What do we know about the prosecutions, these parallel prosecutions? Well, there's precedent for this, plainly federal and state prosecutions going ahead. We have seen this before in the parallel prosecutions of the Minneapolis police officers who killed George Floyd. Remember that? Of course, you do very well. Among the cases that followed a similar path. Another case in that category, the three men who killed Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. All of those federal and state cases as well. Talking more about the implications of parallel proceedings here as Amicus Law Review continues.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matt and Air on Air.
Earl Ingram.
Chuck from East Troy. Good morning to you, Chuck. You say what?
I have a bone to pick with you. Since my wife discovered Civic Media 2 years ago, we are addicted to Civic Media, and you are one of the ringleaders. So anyway, I just want to thank you. Have a good day.
Hey, Chuck, man, thank you very much for the call. Tell your wife I said thank you, and it's an honor and a privilege.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Todd Alba Show.
UW Systems spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants. Three times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK.
This is Amicus. Hello, everybody. My name is Jim Santel. We're spending this, our entire first hour, talking once again about firearms and these events in New York, in Madison of just this past week, just this past month, involving, again, violations of our basic norms, our right to be safe and secure in our public schools, our private schools, our places of community. Noting that in response to the horrific shooting in Manhattan in early December, just recently, both federal and state authorities have prosecuted or brought charges against Luigi Mangione for his violent behavior there. These charges, not unprecedented just before the break, indicating that we've seen this in the George Floyd prosecution. Those officers in Minneapolis charged and ultimately convicted of both federal and state offenses. Why? Why? Because they vindicate, they resolve, and they address different kinds of issues. You can violate federal law while you're also in violating state law. We also note that we saw this in the three people, the private citizens who killed Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, that horrific event. Also prosecuted in a civil rights case, as a murder case, federal and state authorities. The cases against Mangione differ, yes, undeniably. State prosecutors are arguing, of course, that Mangione committed an act of terrorism, as we've seen the DA there. Their federal counterparts, again, the U.S. Attorney's Office down the street, U.S. Attorney's Office there, said that he stalked Brian Thompson, who's the United Healthcare executive, before killing him. Now, there is some tension, if you will, between those two cases, because stalking, of course, is usually directed at a specific person. New York defines terrorism as the intimidation or coercion of a civilian population or government. And so it seems to be on the surface anyway that those two theories of prosecution might run up against each other. But in fact, they're not irreconcilable. You can stalk an individual with the intent to intimidate or coerce a government or a population. For example, if you were stalking a public or political figure. Now, all of this, of course, also raises an issue that many people ask. What about double jeopardy? If you're charging someone with basically the same offense conduct, the underlying facts are the same, but you've got different kinds of charges in different courts, in different jurisdictions. What about the double jeopardy clause that prohibits you from being prosecuted twice for the same offense? And the answer is that the federal government, the state government prosecutions do not run afoul of double jeopardy because they're separate sovereigns. The federal government, state government, different sovereigns in our legal terms. They run around, if you will. They don't really violate in any way double jeopardy. They basically are rules that have been established over many years, including by the Supreme Courts of many states and certainly the United States Supreme Court, that say that double jeopardy not violated when different sovereigns bring different charges for the same conduct. There's a reason for the federal government prosecution. There's a reason for the state prosecution. And as I said before, they vindicate, they approach, they address different kinds of issues. And so the significance of these cannot be overstated. Very likely, the state case, as is often the situation where you've got parallel proceedings, the state case almost certainly to go ahead first. We'll get a trial, if anything. Maybe there'll be a plea ultimately, but perhaps a trial. That will go ahead in New York. And then, depending upon the results of that case A federal trial could proceed as well. In the meantime, both of them can go forward in their particular courts in parallel proceedings. Often the federal court sort of stays back and lets the state court proceeding go ahead to some resolution. Interestingly, again, depending upon what the Department of Justice, the incoming Department of Justice, does, it is entirely possible that the Justice Department under President-elect Donald Trump might want a trial to win a death penalty with respect to Mangione. That is plainly accessible under a federal charge, which you now have present. President Attorney General Merrick Garland, President has moved back from the imposition of the death penalty. A new president coming in with these charges, almost certainly continuing from the past, the present federal administration into the future, almost certainly will continue, could well seek the death penalty under federal law as those cases move ahead. Now, Mangione's lawyer, who is well known in New York circles and beyond, her name is Karen Agnifilo, said that this is a highly unusual situation. She said that there was absolutely no mention of a federal case when she appeared with her client in a state court. She said, "I don't think they even knew that this was going to happen," speaking about the state authorities and the federal authorities. She said, "I've never seen anything like what is happening here." So plainly already defending her client, as she should do. Mr. Mangione is, as always, presumed innocent, is entitled to a defense in our system. A system cannot work without accurate and aggressive and informed and experienced law enforcement, and also equally aggressive and experienced and focused defense counsel in all these cases. She certainly has the right to say those kinds of things, but the reality is that there is precedent for this. And while she may not have seen anything according to what is happening here, as she just said, the reality is there's nothing wrong, there's nothing illegal, there's nothing unconstitutional with having two different sets of charges pending against her client. She plainly would be spending most of her time in the weeks, months, maybe even years ahead, principally in the state court, where once again the DA has charged Mangione with first-degree murder, which again is a terrorism-related offense, to second-degree murder counts and weapons crimes as well. All of that coming out of the horrific violence in Manhattan in early December, visited upon not just the CEO, but I would offer all of us, the victims ultimately of gun violence. As the police chief in Madison said so eloquently just this past week, there's not a single person in the broader community not affected by what happened in the horrific death of those two in Madison, the young student and the teacher as well. The others who are injured, all the members of the community affected dramatically whenever these kinds of things happen, because we're compromised in our safety and our security generally. We will continue to not only report on gun-related events and activities in our localities, in our communities, our states, and our nation, because these are important issues. And to the extent that we begin to think about 2025 and following up on the comments and the suggestions made by my good friend and our community advocate, Earl Ingram, let's make 2025 the year where in Wisconsin we can get some legislative movements on these kinds of things to keep us all more safe and more secure. As we finish up this, our first hour, just a program note as well. This coming Monday, I'm going to be sitting in for Maggie Dawn on Monday, December 23rd. And again, on New Year's Day, sitting in for Maggie Dawn and her show, 2 to 4, the Maggie Dawn Show here on Civic Media. Also, of course, appearing next weekend and the following weekend as Amicus Law Review continues on those settings and continues in the next hour here in our weekend program about law and government and the administration of justice in our nation and across the planet. Stay with us.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Up North News Radio.
Earl Ingram.
Join me on the next show for a Christmas edition of Motown Monday. We'll stroll down memory lane with some of your favorite Christmas songs and get you ready for the holiday.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
Progressive presents Employee of the Month. Small Business Edition. Today's recipient from Terry's Tiny Homes, Terry.
Terry! Sure, as the only employee of her company, Terry was probably the front runner. But saving money getting personalized discounts with a commercial auto quote from Progressive, well, that gave Terry the edge. Over Terry.
Terry! Terry!
Keep awkwardly chanting your own name, Terry. You deserve it.
Woo!
Be your own Terry. See if you could save in as little as 7 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298DK Amory. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The death toll rising to 5 could go higher after Friday evening's attack on a Christmas market in Germany. A driver plowing his car through the crowd, some 200 injured. ABC's Tom-Sophie Burridge at the scene at Magdeburg, Germany.
Tributes for the dead and injured at a church next to the Christmas market. Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz visiting the scene. The German leader saying 40 of the injured are in a critical condition, and we fear for their lives.
A suspect believed to be a 50-year-old doctor originally from Saudi Arabia is in custody. Congress narrowly avoided a government shutdown as the Senate passed a temporary funding plan just after the overnight deadline. The bipartisan bill funds federal operations through March, but without President-elect Trump's demand to raise the debt ceiling. In his final weeks in office, President Biden is forgiving another $4.3 billion in student loan debt for nearly 55,000 borrowers who work in public service. This is ABC News. Leslie.